From the studios of WBAI, listener-supported Pacifica Radio in New York City, the Caldwell Chronicle is on the air. Good morning. I'm Earl Caldwell. On this Monday, the 24th of December, the day before Christmas 2001, it has been confirmed the passenger on the American Airlines flight from Paris to Miami before it was diverted to Logan in Boston, it's been confirmed he was carrying an explosive in his shoe. So he was a 28-year-old man. Some say that before they boarded, they were looking at him. He was off by himself, and he had a suspicious look to him, not suspicious enough. Well, I should say suspicious enough that the airlines had turned him away a day or two earlier. And so another group of airline passengers have a horror story to tell. This one with one of the flight attendants yelling for big men to come back. We need help. Some of the passengers said after the plane finally landed that they believed the fellow was drunk. That's what they had been told, that he was just a little out of order. And then, of course, later, after 10 hours of questioning, they find out what the deal is. The problem, airlines do not have and seem to be resisting. We have been led to believe that the airlines in Europe were further ahead of us here in the States when it comes on the matter of security. Now, that seems like that's not necessarily so. Maybe there is no way to guarantee that these things will not continue to happen. But we do know this. The airlines are going down the tubes. Anybody who can do it, if you have any other way of getting there other than flying, that is the route people want to take now. And for good reason, because it's a crapshoot, it's a gamble. You get on one of these planes and you do not know. And of course, that is not satisfactory. And this is the holiday season. This is the season of travel. This is where people go. Many who can will not go by air. And once these seasons are over, these airlines that have trouble now, they're going to have a lot more trouble coming. And all of the security that the American airlines are promising, it's not in place. It's not in place. And not only is it not in place, they say that they don't know when they're going to be able to deliver. And so, what we hope is going to get better may get worse in the short haul. Just getting started here on this Monday before, the Monday the 24th of December, that day before Christmas. On the Caldwell Chronicle, Paul just joins us on the engineer's desk. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
He is so happy it's Christmas. He think he gonna get some toys.
You're right.
Get nothing.
Thank
you. You've been a bad boy.
Thank you, Earl.
You've been bad.
A poke in the eye with a sharp stick. I'm expecting it. Here it comes. Ah!
Yeah, you will. You will get rewards. Don't worry. Probably when you get your bonus, go on down to the Cadillac dealer. See, we can have levity here because it's the day before Christmas. Pause there because of a story yesterday on the front page of the Washington Post newspaper. Sometimes it takes the paper from out of town to tell you the truth about your own situation. And maybe that's true with New York. Maybe we don't want to see it because we've sort of been battling it in the strangest way. The church on East Side says, well, you can... the homeless, you can sleep on our steps. And the police in the city of New York say, oh, no, you can't sleep there. And so that has sort of framed our problem, a problem of homelessness in a strange kind of way. The Washington Post puts it in a different perspective. And its front page story, it talks about how it's reaching crisis proportions again in New York, saying this: about 29,400 homeless live in city shelters and hot plate hotel rooms each night, including 12,500 children. In the past year, housing costs in New York's poor neighborhoods have spiked sharply, rising far faster than in wealthy districts. And what is happening in New York is happening across the country. A decaying economy, and even more important, a severe lack of affordable housing, driving the current crises, the Washington Post tells us. Homelessness has jumped about 13% nationwide this year. In Chicago, it's up 22%. In San Francisco, up 20%. In Washington, the nation's capital, up 32%. Up 32% in the capital after 4 years of decline. A reporter, Michael Powell from the Washington Post, took a stroll across New York City. And he wrote this: a crisis can be seen and felt in New York City. A random walk across 15 blocks of Midtown Manhattan at 9 o'clock on a recent night found 78 homeless men and a few women asleep on the sidewalks. On a sloping side street off the Grand Concourse in the South Bronx, dozens of families trickle each day into the cement pillbox of a city homeless service office. That's a part of the story on this day before Christmas, 2001. But this homeless story doesn't come without some twins. And here's one. Figures for November, for December are not in yet. Retail sales dropped by 3.7% in the United States in November, led by a 11.9% plunge in auto sales. Fueling the drop in spending has been the loss of some 800,000 jobs in the past 2 months through layoffs, as the U.S. economy officially entered into recession for the first time since 1991. More than 1.6 million layoffs so far in 2001. The number of jobs cuts carried out by individual corporations this year, staggering to say the least. General Electric, 75,000 laid off. Nortel Networks, 50,000 laid off. Lucent Technologies, 40,000 laid off. Motorola, 39,000 laid off. Boeing Aircraft, 38,600 laid off. Daimler Chrysler, 28,700 laid off. Montgomery Ward, 28,000 laid off. Solectron, 20,850. United Airlines, 20,000. AMR Corporation, parent of American Airlines, 20,000 laid off. Honeywell, 16,000 laid off. General Motors, 15,000 laid off. And it goes on like that. So, of course, the number of homeless is rising because there's trouble with the people who had the job. Some little piece that would trickle down here and a piece that would trickle down there. And that's what we have now. A reinstituting of the trickle-down economics. Same as the last time, though. No trickle. And we know this. And we know this. And we know this. The war in Afghanistan has gone so well for the American side that already we are saying we have perfected a whole new way of carrying out these wars. We can deliver these bombs with pinpoint precision. We keep saying that, although the first Americans to suffer the first American casualties came with the smart bombs dropping in the wrong place. Even now they're disputing whether or not large numbers trying to get to the ceremonies installing the new leadership were hit by bombs dropping in the wrong place. But on the other hand, we are saying that this war was quick and swift because we could call in these strikes, pinpoint them, these devastating blows that took away the will to fight and the wherewithal to do it before the Taliban could ever get started. So all what's happening now with the Americans is we're looking around for the next step. We're looking around and asking, where do we go from here? It's said that within the State Department, that within the government, there's a whale of a battle going on. A lot of them want to go into Iraq. They want to go into Baghdad. They want to go right in. Said the State Department, General Powell, Colin Powell, Secretary Powell, say, well, no, no, no. Others say, well, we ought to go to Somalia or Yemen or Sudan. Pick some easier target. Get to Baghdad later. Where will it end? And, of course, there is the Middle East. And this time of year, we call it the Holy Land. And Arafat is saying that he wants to go to Mass in Bethlehem. And Ariel Sharon is saying, no, we're not going to let you go. You cannot do it. Here are two sides standing on the brink of who knows what. And they're like children, these two. The hell with the consequences. Here's Joel Greenberg writing this morning in the New York Times. Yasser Arafat defiantly vowed today to attend Christmas Eve services in Bethlehem after the Israeli government barred him from traveling there, accusing him of failing to crack down on militant groups. The ban set off a flurry of diplomatic activity with American and European officials pressing the Israelis to reconsider their decision. Some Israeli ministers criticized the ban, saying it hurt Israel's image. But both Arafat and Prime Minister Sharon publicly dug in their heels. Arafat told reporters today that no one can prevent me from reaching Bethlehem. No one, whoever he is, has the right, despite the various weapons at his disposal, to prevent this mighty people from fulfilling its religious duties. A spokesman for Mr. Sharon said the government is not going to budge from its decision. With Israeli tanks and armored troop carriers stationed near Mr. Arafat's office, the Israeli checkpoints ringing Ramallah, he has been hemmed in there since his helicopters were destroyed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza 3 weeks ago. Every Christmas Eve since his Palestinian Authority took control of Bethlehem in 1995, Mr. Arafat, who is Muslim, has attended the midnight service at the Church of St. Catherine, which is next to the Church of Nativity, built on the site revered by Christians as the place of Jesus' birth. This is all from the news from the Holy Land. I mean, it just, what is it? What is it? And they, yeah, no, they ask us to choose who's right, Arafat or Sharon. Over the weekend, Jimmy Carter had an op-ed piece, and he was talking about, he says there is still hope. He still thinks there is a way that it can happen, that there can be a coming together. He writes that last month, Secretary of State Colin Powell stated the current American position concerning the Middle East, saying, quote, the Palestinian leadership must end violence, stop incitement, and prepare their people for the hard compromises ahead. All the Arab world must make unmistakably clear that their own actions, their acceptance of Israel, and their commitment to a negotiated settlement. Israel must be willing to end its occupation consistent with the principles embodied in Security Council Resolutions 242 and 338, and accept a viable Palestinian state in which Palestinians can determine their own future on their own land and live in dignity and security. Secretary Powell also said the good news is that the framework for a solution exists. It is based on the core principles of the United Nations Security Council Resolutions 242 and 338, which are rooted in the concept of land for peace. A crucial pledge by both sides was to honor UN Resolutions 242, which was approved in November of 1967 by the United States and Israel, and calls for the withdrawal of Israeli armed forces from territories occupied in the 1967 war, and acknowledgement of the sovereignty and territorial integrities of all states in the area and their right to live in peace with secure and recognized boundaries free from threats and acts of force. A later resolution, Resolution 338, was unanimously adopted immediately after the Yom Kippur War of October 1973. It called for a ceasefire, the immediate implementation of Resolution 242, and negotiations to establish a just and durable peace. In September 1982, President Reagan reaffirmed that the Camp David Agreement remained the foundation of American policy in the Middle East. He added, it is the United States position that, in return for peace, the withdrawal position of Resolution 242 applies to all fronts, including the West Bank and Gaza. His final point was clear. America's commitment to the security of Israel is ironclad. The Palestinians, and a few days ago when I was on the way to the station, I was handed a document. It's called a fact sheet on Israel and Palestine regarding the occupation. The 34-year occupation of the West Bank and Gaza has destroyed the economy of the Palestinians, reducing their average yearly income to a little over $1,000, or about $3 a day, while Israel is at $16,000 per individual, or $48 per day. The United States has dumped more than $40 billion worth of arms in Israel, and Israel is illegally using many of those weapons to put down an uprising against the occupation. More than 2,000 Palestinian homes have been demolished by Israel, tens of thousands of olive trees bulldozed, and a whole generation of young Palestinian men rotated in and out of prison. The Israeli violence against the civilian population continues unabated without any effective U.S. response. Not just the Muslim world, but Europeans are outraged at this silence. The United States has given Israel one of the richer economies, has given Israel one of the richer countries in the world over $100 billion in financial and military aid, mostly after the Camp David Agreement of 1979. This includes billions of dollars in tax-deductible contributions from American supporters of Israel. As our aid to Israel grew, so did Israeli colonies. In 1979, there were 12,000 Jewish Israeli colonists in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. Today, there are over 350,000. With regards to Jerusalem, which is the point of contention on this Christmas Eve, says this: since 1967, Israel has allowed Palestinians to live and build on only 13% of their land in East Jerusalem. Meanwhile, yet Israel continues to build and expand colonies on the rest of the land for the 180,000 Jewish Israeli colonists who have settled in East Jerusalem. In 1993, Israel sealed off Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Hundreds of thousands of Christian and Muslim Palestinians are denied access to Jerusalem, including to their holy sites. Since September the 11th, United States' interests in the Middle East have been challenged to find a new formula for peace between Israel and the Palestinians. This problem is at the heart of regional animosity directed at the United States. In 14 months, more than 800 Palestinians, including 150 children, have been killed by the Israeli Defense Forces acting on the government of Israel's direct orders. More than 16,000 Palestinians have been seriously injured. This is comparable to 56,000 Americans being killed in 1 year and 1.6 million seriously injured. Israel has lost 170, including 20 children, equivalent to 8,000 Americans being killed. Secretary Powell is making a renewed effort at a ceasefire with the vision that it would lead to negotiations, including an end to the occupation and the creation of a Palestinian state. The Sharon government has made it clear that there will be no end to the occupation and no removal of Jewish Israeli colonies. The U.S. refuses, except with the agreement of both parties, to have international monitoring of the Palestinian areas, knowing that Israel rejects this. But there are 5,000 U.N. troops monitoring events on the Israel border with Lebanon, Syria, and Egypt. Secretary Powell still not making the crucial connection between our, it's a Palestinian, and anti-terror fight and the necessity of ending the occupation. Secretary Powell stated that the occupation should end, but our Palestinian government is still our American government is still reassuring Sharon that we will not pressure him to give back Palestinian lands. Secretary Powell is still not making the crucial connection between our American anti-terror fight and the necessity of ending this occupation. Secretary Powell has stated that this occupation should end, but our government, American government, is still reassuring Sharon that we will not pressure him to give back Palestinian lands. Some of the sides to this Holy Land dispute that just keeps getting worse and uglier and going on and on. It is 31 minutes past the hour, and Admiral Caldwell, this is our Christmas, well, hours before Christmas Eve, day before Christmas. This is our Monday broadcast. Andrea Clark is our engineer this morning, our engineer and guiding light. And we're going to take, it's 31 minutes past the hour. For station ID, this is WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-supported Pacifica Radio in New York City. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back after this. on WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-supported Pacifica Radio in New York City. This is the Caldwell Chronicle. I'm Earl Caldwell on this Monday, 24 December 2001. Did you hear this? Did you get this? Do you believe this? Time Magazine's Man of the Year, Rudolph, not the red-nosed reindeer, Rudolph Giuliani. If they would have said the man of the last 2 weeks, right on. Hey, give him 2 weeks. 2 months, maybe. Man of the Year, it just tells me how out of touch time has become. Now I know why my buddy Jack White took the buyout and said, I'll see you later. Time Magazine does not know. I would like to see them go back. You look at his record. Look at his record. And tell me how you put Man of the Year in his hands. Man of 2 weeks? Yes. There were 2 or 3 weeks there where he did do his job. But as soon as he began to do his job, and as soon as celebrity came to him, the first thing he did is set the city on edge by saying, I should stay on. I should not leave. We don't need this election. And then that created a whole bunch of mess. One of about 3 or 4 times he went meddling into the election and into the Democrats' primary. Time overlooks all that, of course. Doesn't mean anything. And when the city of New York, facing all of the financial problems that it's facing, this man of the year could not bring himself. We're talking about all the homeless, all of the problems that are mounting for this city. This mayor sitting on top of all this celebrity could not bring himself to use a bit of that to argue the case to the federal government to give the city the finances that it promised would be coming. And he knows, and we know, that when they say, oh, wait, we'll catch you next year, we'll get you down the line, you're going to play hell getting that money. Giuliani could have turned that around. Giuliani could have turned that around. There was no way that Bush would say to him, oh, no, we're going to stiff you. I know we came up and made the promise. I know we said we're going to do it, but we're going to stiff you. No way they could have said it. What Time Magazine is saying is that some things that a lot of New Yorkers, a lot of people who live in this city, a lot of people who are around their little midtown Manhattan neighborhoods, Time Magazine saying these people do not count. Time Magazine says it doesn't give a... Time Magazine says, as a matter of fact, said we're going to reward you for your attitude. Over the last couple of days, Jonathan Hicks, the New York Times, one of the more astute political observers, reporters, he's been looking at what some of this Giuliani attitude means and coming up with some of the facts, and some of it we know, but it's still stunning, about in this whole period of his mayoralty, all through the 8 years, he wouldn't even say good morning to so many of the black elected officials, let alone discuss any city problems, any problems from their communities. These people are telling now about how wonderful it is that Mayor-elect Bloomberg is just listening to them, just reaching out and acknowledging that they are a part of the leadership of New York City. Giuliani wouldn't do that. His arrogant, twisted, devilish, depraved idiocy wouldn't allow him. No. And a lot of precincts in New York City, people are counting these last few days of Giuliani's time and saying good riddance. Time magazine is a good reflection of the division between the haves and the have-nots, of the divisions based on race, of the kind of divisions that this mayor has built up in his two terms in office in New York. Man of the year, give me a break. Give me a break. So far out of touch. But this is the media in New York City. There's two sides. One that's for the Manhattanites, for the haves, and the other, forget it. That was about Time Magazine, now Time Warner's publication, and when they're taken down the tubes. This is about Mort Zuckerman. This is about Mort Zuckerman, who has done more to promote censorship in the media in New York City than anyone I can think of, and nobody says a word. I'm thinking about Juan Gonzalez. Juan Gonzalez sits over there drawing his fat paycheck at the Daily News and uses that position to come and try to drive this station off the air, out of business, and tries to carry his vendetta against black men here. He does that on a consistent basis, but he will not open his mouth about any of the racist censorship issues right there on his doorstep. Listen to this. A small black child picks up a phone and calls the FBI's terrorist tip line. Quote, "Spare me the surprised indignation, Huey. You know we've been tapping your phones for years. What you got?" the voice on the other end demanded. "I'm very serious. I know several Americans who have helped train and finance Osama bin Laden," the kid says. "Okay, give me some names." The guy on the FBI's terrorist tip line demands. "All right," the kid says, "let's see. The first one is Reagan. R-E-A-G-A. Hello? Hello?" The comic strip ends. The boy was Huey Freeman, the creation of comic strip writer Aaron Magruder, a young black activist with a degree in African-American studies from the University of Maryland, who has been inking his social satire of black Americans trying to adjust to life in the white suburbs since his days in College Park. Diamondback, back to when your humble correspondent used to go to school there in 1995, 1996. Since he finished his degree in 1998, his career has spiraled. He was picked up by The Source, a major black culture magazine in the United States and went into national syndication in most daily newspapers a few months later. But readers of those same major dailies didn't get a chance to see the comic strip we mentioned above. Nor did they get to see the strip where Magruder's character explains that George Bush funded the Taliban, or the one in which the young avatar of black male rage compares Bush and bin Laden, sarcastically stating how glad he is not to live in a country run by the privileged son of an oil baron who thinks it is his duty to go hurling bombs at foreign countries. Something Magruder was saying didn't match the agenda of America's shadow elite. And so Magruder got the boot. That's from a piece written by Bill White, found on the internet. Correspondent White goes on to say, the first to reject him, the first to reject Magruder's column, first to do so most publicly was Mortimer Zuckerman, head of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, a conglomerate body of 55 Jewish organizations to come together in a yearly meeting to decide on a single policy line on Israel, to which the entire organized Jewish community in the United States is expected to adhere. Zuckerman, who owns the New York Daily News, the U.S. News and World Report magazine, made it a point to yank Magruder's strip, saying it doesn't belong being published in New York. Shadow government speak, quote, for opposition to war is contrary to the interests of America's Zionist Jewish community. It wasn't also surprising. Well, the point there is made. Mort Zuckerman, who in Juan Gonzalez's time, and I make Juan Gonzalez the point man in this, because he goes around the country. He went all the way to Houston, Texas, to stand up in a meeting of the room of the Pacifica Foundation and bang on the table and tell how he was going to burn that board down and how he was going to do it using the pulpit given to him at the Daily News. That's a fact. And he's been on the point saying he would drive these stations under the ground if they don't operate the way he says, if they don't meet what he calls his standards. But he can't bring himself to support any kind of fairness, any kind of anti-censorship, or any stand against the racism. While he stood with his mouth shut, wouldn't open his mouth, Mort Zuckerman fired every black man in the city room at the New York Daily News. I know this. I was in that paper. I had my own experiences there. I know whereof I speak on this. I do not need Bill White. I simply use him this morning because he has carried this Daily News piece out into the public because they have this conspiracy of silence in the media of New York. You don't tell about me, I won't tell about you. In the case of censorship at the Daily News, when I was attempting to write in my column a story about a police officer who was accused of inflicting homosexual rape on a number of immigrant residents of the city, a group of men, all black, from Africa and the Caribbean who went to the late Nat Lorendi, who virtually, he was the man who really perfected the lie detector test in the NYPD, Nat Lorendi. They went to Lorendi and submitted the lie detector test. Lorendi came and looked me in the eye. We talked. He said he could not find any evidence that any of these men were lying, and yet no newspapers would publish the story, and they came to me, and I said, well, I have this tiny space in the Daily News in my column. I will tell that story. Of course, the rest of that's history. It came down to my being able to tell the story in my column in the Daily News. I was out. That was under this Mort Zuckerman. Juan Gonzalez didn't open his mouth. He didn't open his mouth. But he's been over here being a part of this group that are threatening people yet today. Get his automobile license number. We got sources in the police department to go after him. Hounding people on their jobs and in their neighborhoods, but turning their backs on the racism, the censorship that is underneath their noses. There are hidden agendas here. And Juan Gonzalez is the front man on all of this. He is the front man. He can't bring himself to stand up to these people where he goes and gets his paycheck every week. But he runs over here to burn these stations down. He can't bring himself to stand up to a white man . He gives these black men fits. He digs into their personal lives and is a party to put in anything he can find in personal backgrounds and said, we'll attack you on the basis of this, or attack them in the vulnerability of their jobs. So far out of order, it stinks. This is Juan Gonzalez. And he makes his name in New York as supposedly the progressive. The progressive who can't open his mouth but to serve his master. But when it comes to attacking people of color, he's on the front line to do that job. This is the record he has made. This is his record. And I bring it up now on this day before Christmas because for some people, this is just an experience. For some people, they walk out of one door. It's a revolving thing that they're involved in. They can go from here to there, walk across the street. Doesn't make any difference. They're not at the Daily News. They'll be at the New York Post. They're not at the Daily News. They'll be over to the New York Times. They move from paper to paper. They go around in the circle. People of color don't have that option. The black men who were run out of the Daily News could not get back anywhere. And they were run out for a reason. They were run out for a reason. They were the people who were strong enough. When confronted with the kind of racism that was put on them, had the courage and the guts to put their jobs and their well-being and their family's well-being, put it all on the line to fight, to stand and fight for what they believed in. And they fought and they won. Daily News is the only newspaper in America. It was convicted of its racism. That happened because of black men who were not afraid to stand and fight for what they believed in. Mort Zuckerman got that paper. The first order of business, his first order of business, was to get rid of the black, the senior blacks on the paper. All of them, everybody. That was his record. He did that. Juan Gonzalez got his job at the Daily News on the back of the struggle made by blacks. That is a fact. That is documented. Don't take my word for it. Ask David Hardy. He has the documents. That's a fact. Black folks got him his job, and now he uses that position to ruin the lives of black men. Black men who are serving on the Pacifica board, not for any money, given their time, their energies, and their efforts. And who is Juan Gonzalez representing? And who is he representing? He's representing, I suppose it would say, the